Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Harrison in Providence. U.S. Senator Jack Reed is calling on Washington politicians to stop the political brinksmanship and reopen the federal government. He's also criticizing House Republicans for their unwillingness to come to a compromise that would raise the debt ceiling and avoid a federal default. Rhode Island's other U.S. Senator, Sheldon Whitehouse, says even the threat of a default could harm Americans.
The threat will hurt people. It will raise interest rates a little. It will make people a little bit more skeptical. And ultimately, the costs of being a little bit skeptical about American sovereign debt is something the taxpayers have to pay for.
Whitehouse made the comment yesterday during an interview on NPR's Here and Now. The Senate is hoping for a vote today on an agreement to raise the debt ceiling and stop the partial government shutdown. Diane Ravitch, a national critic of standardized testing, spoke last night at the University of Rhode Island. She told a crowded auditorium that Race to the Top has been a waste of money, in part because it focused on teacher evaluations based on test scores. Ravitch says teachers are not the problem in public schools.
Many of our lowest performing schools, where the test scores are horrible, have excellent teachers, but they're dealing with tremendous problems of A, kids who don't speak English, B, disproportionate numbers of kids with disabilities, and with the kids of poverty who have asthma, who missed many days of school. I mean, the problems of our society are enormous, and we're blaming everything on the schools, and that's wrong.
Rhode Island education officials have defended teacher evaluations and high school graduation systems that include standardized test scores. They say students and teachers should be held accountable for their performance. And they point out that test scores are just one measure used to rate teachers. The state also uses classroom observations and personal performance goals in teacher evaluations. Congressman Jim Langevin says he was among the legions of people who were duped by Cranston estate planner Joseph Caramadre. As Rhode Island Public Radio's Flo Jonick reports, the congressman donated money he made as a profit from Caramadre's unscrupulous scheme.
Congressman Jim Langevin says he unwittingly made a profit on an investment scheme that preyed on terminally ill people. Langevin says he earned a profit of $8,600 from Joseph Caramadre's Cranston estate planning business. Langevin says he donated the profit to charity as soon as he became aware of Caramadre's business practices. Caramadre has pled guilty to stealing the identities of terminally ill patients in order to profit from death benefits paid on annuity policies issued without their knowledge. Other Caramadre investors include Virginia gubernatorial candidate Terry McAuliffe and the law firm of former Central Falls receiver Robert Flanders. Caramadre is currently awaiting sentencing. Flo Jonick, Rhode Island Public Radio.
And Boston fans are celebrating the Red Sox's second consecutive win against Detroit in the American League Championship Series. The Sox now lead that series 2-1. Yesterday's game was a pitcher's duel, with neither side letting a run through during the first 6 innings. Then in the 7th inning, Boston's Mike Napoli hit one out of the park.
High fly ball to left center. Back at the wall, the Red Sox have taken the lead. Napoli gets Verlander here in the 7th.
That sealed the deal. The Sox went on to win the game 1-0. They'll face the Tigers again tonight in Detroit for Game 4 in their playoff series.
You're known for having really terrific sources within the Rhode Island court system. How were you able to cultivate those sources when people working in the courts are not supposed to be giving out secrets to reporters?
I started covering the court beat, you know, back in 1974, and I realized right away, I mean, lawyers and judges talk in this foreign language, and I was going to really have to learn how to understand that. So I actually went to some judges and lawyers whose work I respected when I was watching them in the courtroom, and asked them just outside of court if I didn't understand something to help. And then my predecessors on that beat were two older men, and, you know, they had curried a lot of favor with members of the bar, but most of the stories they wrote were not particularly critical. Then I came on, and a lot of the old-time lawyers didn't like me because I started ruffling feathers, but I think people in the court system realized that I was trying to sort of uncover the real story there, whether it was good or bad, and that the chips would fall where they may, and I think I built respect over the years. I mean, I spent, of all of the years I spent at the Providence Journal, I probably lived half of my life in that courthouse over on Benefit Street. So I was there every day. And I think I became known as somebody that was also a voice for the powerless and the voiceless. So as much as I love talking to lawyers and judges, it was just as satisfying, or maybe more satisfying, talking to the victims of crime and people who felt like they hadn't gotten a fair shake. I mean, that's the courthouse is the place where the drama of everyday life plays out every single day. And so to me, that was the best beat of all.
Tracy, you've covered a lot of big cases over the years for the Providence Journal. One of the biggest was the murder case against Newport socialite Klaus von Bülow, who was ultimately acquitted in 1985 on charges of killing his wife, Sunny. Almost 30 years later, what are your main takeaways from that case?
Well, that was the first case that was covered gavel to gavel by CNN. And, I mean, it attracted an international media crowd, and it had all of the elements that would attract public interest. I mean, there was tremendous wealth. There was an unusual alleged method of attempted murder by insulin. Some of the biggest socialites and most well-known people in Newport were coming to testify, either for or against. And some of the best lawyers in the country were involved in prosecuting and defending that case.
You were part of a team that won a 1994 Pulitzer Prize at the Journal for revealing wrongdoing in the Rhode Island court system. How did that story get started? How did you get on the trail of it? And what was the key to getting it?
Well, I wasn't the person that actually got the tip that started that investigation. I think it was Kathy Gregg actually getting something and simultaneously.
Kathy Gregg, still the State House Bureau Chief for the Journal.
Yes, she is. And she didn't actually end up writing stories that were involved in that series, but something that somebody passed along to her. And I think my memory is that simultaneously also John Sullivan, who's a former reporter here, who then went to the New York Times, he also got a tip. And it started really very small with we were looking at some money that was missing from a court fund. And the target of that investigation was the son of somebody who was in Rhode Island government.
Back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, two chief justices of the Rhode Island Supreme Court resigned while under heavy scrutiny. How has the court system changed for the better or worse since then in Rhode Island?
I do have to say, in retrospect, that the Bevilacqua thing obviously was very distasteful and disturbing to the citizens of the state. But, you know, he was an incredible court administrator. He had background as a leader in our state house. He was always incredibly welcoming to me and made my job a whole lot easier. He got in trouble for associating with people outside of the court. There was never sort of any taint on the decisions that he wrote about, but obviously that was behavior that could not be tolerated. When it came to Tom Fay, he also was a wonderful help to me in covering the system, made it easier for me to do things, and it was very surprising when all these things started uncovering. Do I think that we have a better judicial selection system now? I would have to say I think it's still just as political as it was before. I don't see that there's really any less political influence that goes into selecting the judges. So while there's this merit selection thing and the public is allowed to come in and, you know, ask questions and see this in this very sort of transparent way, I don't think that the system has changed at all.
You've left the Providence Journal as part of the latest in a series of buyouts there. We've seen the reporting staff reduced over time through a series of these buyouts and layoffs. How will the Journal be able to do investigative reporting and thorough reporting on areas like the courts going forward after these reductions in the staff size?
I don't know, to be honest. One of the reasons I left is because I felt like, you know, with all of these buyouts and layoffs, that the staff was getting really thin. And just from my perspective, I was afraid that I wasn't going to be able to continue to do the kind of stories that I still want to write for the rest of my life. That said, there are some wonderful people and good reporters and editors that are still left there. The question is what kind of resources we're going to have to be able to do much beyond covering the tip of the news.
You plan to continue teaching at Brown University, where you've been teaching journalism for some time now. Looking at the changes in journalism, how do you feel about the profession going into the future?
It's a noble profession, and, you know, I wouldn't have chosen anything else to spend the last 40 years doing, and I continue to write, and the students that I have at Brown are committed to wanting to do journalistic writing and reporting, whether it be in print or electronic or, you know, radio media or television reporting. I'm concerned that there aren't going to be enough good jobs out there for them, and I'm also concerned that so many of these journalism programs are canceling courses in things like investigative reporting and political public affairs reporting and replacing them with skills-based things on how to make good websites and do a lot of stuff on the web, which I think you could learn in a night class. Luckily, where I'm teaching at Brown, the emphasis has all been on the writing and the reporting. I teach out of the English department in the nonfiction writing program, and the emphasis is on good writing and good reporting, and I'm happy to say that a lot of my students are doing that at wonderful places, ranging from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times to the Washington Post in a terribly difficult time. But also, I don't plan to stop writing. I mean, one of the reasons that I left the journal was because I'm working on a book proposal on something, and I'll continue doing some freelance writing as well. I don't think I could ever stop writing.
Can you share with us the subject of your book proposal?
I'm going to be expanding a story that I wrote for the journal in February about Joe Kinnon, the most badly burned station fire survivor who got a hand transplant, and the young man who died and gave him his hand, and some of the other people that got his organs.
Tracy Breton, thank you for sitting down with us and best wishes.
Thanks so much, Ian. It's always a pleasure.
It's October, and that means students across Rhode Island are filling in bubbles on standardized tests. The annual use of testing in math and English has become a controversial tool for rating schools and making decisions about high school diplomas, and it will soon be part of teacher evaluations, too. One researcher who started out supporting standardized testing now says it's part of the problem in public schools. Diane Ravitch has become one of the strongest voices in the national debate, and she spoke at the University of Rhode Island last night. Before her talk, she took a few minutes to speak with Rhode Island Public Radio. Diane Ravitch, it's great to have you in the Ocean State.
Elizabeth, it's wonderful to be with you.
Your new book, Reign of Error, focuses on what you call the privatization of public education. So I'd like to unpack that term a little bit. What do you mean by privatization?
I mean that what we've been seeing over the past decade, since the passage of No Child Left Behind, is that the test scores are used to tell a narrative of failure, which I show is not true. Our American public schools are actually a tremendous success. And yet the story is our schools are a failure, our schools are broken, the test scores are low. We have to find something, anything to do with them. We have to turn them over to private management. We have to have vouchers. We have to have charters. And so the testing becomes an integral part of the privatization movement because it provides this data, which is overhyped, to say we have to dismantle public education. What I argue in my book is public education is working very well indeed, except where there is high poverty and high racial segregation. And where those conditions exist, the schools are in terrible trouble.
Now, let's talk a little bit about charter schools. Rhode Island has 19 charter schools right now, and all but two of them are homegrown charter schools. And what I mean by that is they're not for-profit companies. They're not franchise charter chain schools. They're publicly funded nonprofits started by local residents who are looking for a way to better serve students. Are these schools part of the privatization movement that you speak of?
You know, there are different kinds of charter schools. There are charter schools that actually meet the needs of the local community. If a charter school is addressing the needs of, let's say, for example, dropouts, that's a very valuable help to the public schools. If the charter school is taking the weakest students and helping them catch up, if it's taking the students who have low motivation and low test scores who are completely tuned out of school, that's a very valuable adjunct to the public schools. What charter schools and public schools should do is collaborate. What most charter schools do today is that they skim. They don't take the kids with the extreme disabilities. They don't take the kids who are English learners. Or if they take any, they take a very small proportion, and those with the mildest disabilities. And in that way, they actually harm public education.
But a lot of charter school advocates say, you know, there are some charter schools that are not succeeding, but there are many that are doing very well. And even in Rhode Island, we see some charter schools that are far outperforming the regular public schools in their same districts. What do you say to parents who are looking for better alternatives and they see those schools with better test scores?
But you have to look at the particular school. Does the school accept the children who have disabilities? Does the school exclude the English learners? Does the school kick out the kids with low test scores? That can become very dangerous to public education because it turns us into a society of consumers instead of citizens. People begin to say, what's in it for my child? I want my child to go to the school where all the kids are white. I want my child to go to the school where there are no English learners, where there are no troublemakers, where there are no kids with disabilities. And then we begin to have a consumer society where the rule becomes segregation.
I'd like to turn now to a controversial policy in Rhode Island that ties high school diplomas to standardized test scores. Students starting this year have to show at least partial proficiency on the state test, which they take as 11th graders. And if they don't, they can retake the test. They will be allowed to graduate if they improve. But this has been very controversial in Rhode Island. And Diane Ravitch, I'm curious, what do you think of this use of standardized testing as a sort of high school exit exam?
Well, I'm opposed to the use of standardized testing. I think the test should be made by the teachers. I think the teachers who know the kids make the best judgment about whether they're ready to graduate or not. I think in Rhode Island, you're going to see a dramatic number of kids unable to get a high school diploma. You may see as many as 15 or 20%, 25 or 30% of kids who cannot graduate high school. These kids are going to be ruined for life because of some stupid standardized test. And I say stupid because I spent 7 years on the Federal Testing Board, and I can tell you that many of these standardized test questions are poorly written. Many of the answers are wrong. There's no right answer, or there are two right answers, or the smart kids gets the wrong answer because they thought about it too much. The tests increasingly are going to be graded on a computer. They're going to be taken on a computer and graded on a computer. So we're not raising the quality of education by using standardized tests.
Well, the difficulty in part in Rhode Island is we are seeing a large number of students graduate from high school and still need at least one remedial course when they get to our community colleges. I think the number is about 75% of students needing at least one remedial course at the Community College of Rhode Island. How do we make sure that students are mastering the basic math and English they need before we hand them a diploma?
You have to remember that we've been in the era of standardized testing for at least the last dozen years. So every one of the students coming out of Rhode Island high schools today have grown up in the era of No Child Left Behind that required that they take standardized tests every single year. Something is terribly wrong with this narrative. Standardized tests don't teach anybody anything. So we have gained nothing from 12 years of focusing on standardized testing. One of the things that I recommend in my recent book is that we look to the example of Finland. In Finland, they have no standardized testing at all. They have only, at the very end of high school, they have a standardized test for getting into college. But the kids go from the beginning of school until the end of 12th grade without ever taking a standardized test, and they do extremely well.
Rhode Island's Education Commissioner Deborah Gist has championed this new testing graduation requirement, and she's a strong supporter as well of using test scores as part of a comprehensive evaluation of teachers that's rolling out now in Rhode Island. She also helped the state win a $75 million Race to the Top grant. It's funding a wide variety of initiatives, including training on the Common Core standards and a program for transformative principals. Diane Ravitch, how would you grade Commissioner Gist's approach to public education?
Well, I wouldn't grade Commissioner Gist. I think that, you know, she has her job to do, and obviously the people who are in charge of the state like what she's doing. I happen to believe, and I'm going to explain in my lecture, that evaluating teachers by the test scores of their student doesn't work. It's been tried now over several years. Bill Gates has put hundreds of millions of dollars into doing it. Arne Duncan has poured over $4 billion into doing it. It hasn't worked anywhere. What has happened is when you evaluate teachers by the test scores of their students, the teachers who teach difficult children look bad. The teachers who teach in the affluent suburbs look like good teachers. When you ask teachers, why were you effective this year and last year you were ineffective, they say, I have no idea. I did the same thing both years. Nobody understands the metrics. Literally, no one in this country understands the metrics of using test scores to evaluate teachers. It is invalid, it is unstable, and the ratings are completely meaningless.
But in Rhode Island's system, the test scores are just one part of the measure. There are other factors, including classroom visits, goals that teachers set for themselves, and how well they achieve those goals. It's not just the test scores. Is there any role for test scores in a teacher evaluation?
No, there's no role at all for test scores in a teacher evaluation. We do not have bad teachers. I know that your own evaluation showed 95% of your teachers were rated as effective. And, of course, everybody started backtracking and saying, oh, that can't be true. Well, as a matter of fact, in every state that has a teacher evaluation system, it turns out that something like 95 or 98% of the teachers are, in fact, effective. We have very good teachers in American public schools. In fact, many of our lowest performing schools where the test scores are horrible have excellent teachers, but they're dealing with tremendous problems of A, kids who don't speak English, B, disproportionate numbers of kids with disabilities, and with the kids of poverty who have asthma, who miss many days of school. I mean, the problems of our society are enormous, and we're blaming everything on the schools, and that's wrong.
So if better teacher evaluations are not the answer, if standardized testing is not the answer, what would you propose as some solutions for families who are looking around at their local public school and saying, this isn't where I want to send my kid?
There are many things that we should do. Among them, we should have universal pre-kindergarten, universal early childhood education. We should have health clinics attached to every school where kids are poor. We should have arts in every school. Every school should have a vibrant arts program. There should be physical education every day. Every school should have a balanced curriculum that includes foreign languages and history and civics and mathematics and science, the arts. All of these things are part of what make good schools. Every school needs parent involvement. So if I were a parent in any city in Rhode Island, in any town in Rhode Island, I wouldn't say, how can I get a charter school? I would get involved and say, how can I make our school a better school? How can I work with the parents? How can teachers and parents work together with the principal to make sure that this school meets the needs of this community? We want our kids to have what the kids at the very finest private schools have.
Diane Ravitch from New York University, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It's been a pleasure.
Education reporting on Rhode Island Public Radio is funded in part by a grant by the Rhode Island Foundation, Rhode Island's only community foundation, and New England Institute of Technology's Center for Technology and Industry.